Paper 36, section 4, which is old single column, page 400. All right, so remember we're very methodically stepping our way through the life carrier paper here. There's been lots and lots of really intriguing passages that we've been expanding upon. So we're just chugging along. You see, we're starting the section about the Melchizedek life carriers tonight, and just to remind us of how much context there is. About this all the time, about this relationship between the life carriers and the Melchizedeks, they've been pointing out and we've been reminding you of over and over again. Let's just look at that last paragraph of the previous section before we start reading, and one little tidbit that we didn't expand on, because it segues into the reading tonight. When they said, remember how at the end of that section they were reminding us of how there's these stages to the life carriers engaging the issue of the evolution of life, the implantation and the evolution of life, and three stages, and they literally are in three different states of being, their body, their the energy system that is their body, is first in a very literal electrochemical level nature, so that they can directly interact with the material structures that they're assembling and are going to be the means for life being bestowed into them. And then they're in their normal mid-phase mode for a long, long, long stretch of time as life is evolving until you finally get to will creatures. And then they're put into that third phase, which is a semi-spiritual phase. And the ones that are still here today are in, still in that mode. They've been in that mode for almost a million years since Andan and Fanta, developed to the point where the seventh adjutant engaged, and they were encircled in the Holy Spirit, and their personality engaged, and off they went as the first volitional beings on the planet. Okay, and they made that comment about that point. Upon the arrival of a planetary prince, they, the life carriers, prepare to leave. Okay, and we don't need to go through all the other details there, but just that little specific point. Normally the planetary prince arrives, right around the time that you have the first will creatures on a world, but not on our world. The life carriers designed, into the process a pre-sangic will creature. And it came to pass just as they designed it. 550 million years later, it came to pass that they got Andan and Fanta. As it often is, a pair of red men, crossing the threshold of will dignity, but a completely separate race, a pre-sangic race, they were trying to see if they could achieve will creatures in an even more minimal mode than normal. It's so minimal what they achieved with Andan and Fanta that they're not able to be engaged in the normal scheme by a planetary prince and his staff, who come as civilizational developers and uplifters. Fundamentally, the Andanites are not civilizable creatures yet. They don't have the requisite significant engagement of the seventh adjutant Yeah, I mean, they have it, but not at the level in order to really get a phenomenon going that a planetary prince and his staff can work with. And so there's 500 million years, or 500,000 years, you're just saying the million thing, right? 500,000 years where before the planetary prince and his staff arrive, until they arrive simultaneously with the Sangic races 500,000 years ago. So what was going on during that time? I mean, normally you need someone to be overseeing the will creatures, because like we were just reading there, the life carriers, have been really leading things on the planet. They've been the directors of the planet up to this point. And they have to back off as soon as there's will creatures. So who takes over leading the planet? Well, we had this special case of, sure enough, Melchizedek's. They're always the ones that fill those gaps of, some special circumstance or some emergency circumstance where the normal scheme doesn't, can't be applied. And so we had 12 Melchizedek's that came and took over, guiding the planet, directing the planet until the planetary prince. They're not the Melchizedek receivers, quote unquote. They're not receiving it from a rebellion or default. Okay, so they're not called receivers. They're called Melchizedek observers. And they're a different set of 12 than the 12 that came to be the 12 Melchizedek receivers, subsequently. So you've got this set of 12 Melchizedek's, again, demonstrating this very intimate relationship with the life carriers. You can imagine that it's probably a very close, sort of dual leadership in a sense, but with the Melchizedek's in the lead because they're so close. It may not be quite as such when you actually have the planetary prince. The planetary prince is probably more, definitively, in charge with the life carriers as a secondary fact, as advisors. But the life carriers on our world for those times may have been a lot more of like co-leaders to a degree because of the closeness between the Melchizedek's and the life carriers. Okay, so now we're about to see. Even more so, they are very close. This example, the first time that you read the Revelation, if it really sinks in what's being said here, it's pretty startling, as we'll see here when we read the first paragraph. Let's jump in here.
Number four, Melchizedek life carriers. In every local system of inhabited worlds throughout Nebadon, there is a single sphere whereon the Melchizedek's have functioned as life carriers. These abodes are known as the system Midsonite worlds, and on each of them a materially modified Melchizedek son has mated with a selected daughter of the material order of sonship. The mother Eves of such Midsonite worlds are dispatched from the system headquarters of jurisdiction, having been chosen by the designated Melchizedek life carrier from among the numerous volunteers who respond to the call of the system sovereign addressed to the material daughters of his sphere.
Okay, so when we were reading the previous paper, back there in the beginning when we were unpacking the details they gave us about the Melchizedek, remember how we, I very definitively emphasized those couple spots where they're giving you something that's quite fascinating to try to wrap your mind around, that these Melchizedek's have this very vast vertical nature to their energy system that is their body. Okay, and remember how they said that it's very easy for them to to turn the knob inside, whatever heck this, dial is that modifies how their energy system is in relationship to matter, mind, and spirit, and to finite space and time, and, you know, and all these things that we don't quite understand, but somehow or other, I mean, they literally can just buy, you know, like the secondary midwares, make themselves materially manifest. For instance, so that when you've got the first magisterial son, and they're incarnated, remember, as an adult, you know, like Machiavelli was 4,000 years ago, the 12 Melchizedeks that accompany that magisterial son are always in the same form as the magisterial son. So if he's in corporeal form, they are too. Okay, but they're not incarnated when they're accompanying like that. They're just turning the knob and manifesting materially. Okay, and so now it, you know, you really have it right in front of you. Okay, you know, we're not talking about some sort of vague materialness or something. I mean, literally, so definitively material, just like me, that they mate with a material daughter, have sex with a material daughter, and have children, okay, in the normal way. She gets pregnant, and it's babies in the womb. She gives birth, okay? That Melchizedek, okay? And when they say they are a Melchizedek life carrier, remember how they said that, not with decimal worlds, but in general, the life carriers, you know, actually carry the germplasm from their labs where they've designed it, you know, and bring it to the planet where they're going to implant life. Okay, Melchizedek life carrier. Okay, in other words, he carries that germplasm just like I carry germplasm. Okay, it's that literal what we're talking about here. Okay, now that's a pretty startling thing. If you've had any ideas about celestial beings or something before you read the Revelation, it was undoubtedly kind of fuzzy and vague, and if you drew a picture of them, they weren't that specific in form. Okay, but here you have to confront it directly. I mean, you literally have, So just, to understand how this fact of turning the knob, and varying how they manifest. When we were talking earlier, okay, I mean, in order for me to be me, I have to have, my genetic nature, my chromosomes, and I have to do mitosis and meiosis, like we were talking about last time. If I'm going to make germ cells, I have to be able to do that meiosis thing. And I have to have the reproductive spark engaged to me in order to have that meiosis animated. I can't just have the living vitality. Okay, see, so these Melchizedeks, have the reproductive spark, okay? And when they make themselves materially manifest, it's just like a material male. It's all the DNA and the meiosis process that produces germ cells, okay? So, that's a literalness to the heavenly hosts, that has never been contemplated before. I mean, except in, there's always been some idea of, because of the Bible, and the sons of God, had children with the daughters of men, there's always been some notion, that celestial beings like angels could somehow have sexual relations with humans, and of course we have all kinds of like the Greek gods, doing this sort of stuff and whatnot, But, that's all in a pretty just human anthropomorphic thinking about things mode. There's no anthropomorphism here. This is the Revelation trying to get us to understand just how literal energy bodies are of all flavors, and how not that different in some, in many ways, a spirit being is from us. So when you get a spirit being that has one of these, abilities to morph their manifestation of energy, they come out fully equipped as a material being, okay? All right, go ahead.
So do you think that's what Jesus did when he appeared as a Maranatha being? Had that same kind of ability?
No, because there they tell you specifically that the master physical controllers, you know, are, you know, sort of putting a material skin on him, quote unquote. You know, they're making a hologram, you know, sort of a literal material, you know, encasement of him that expresses his Maranatha nature.
One other thing is that, you know, a lot of times in class you talk about things that, you know, seem like they're, well, not miracles or magic. And something like that, you know, when you really picture that in your mind about the various different states that they can put themselves in, has that little sort of miraculous or magical tone to it.
Yeah.
Person of my order.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you couldn't hear it on the webinar, he's just pointing out, you know, it all sounds pretty magical. And you think about this, you know, and they, you remember they said that, you know, they can manifest themselves as all kinds of different orders of being, you know, those orders are fundamentally different because they have a different, blending of the energies to make a body, and they can just dial themselves around and, okay. And
somebody tried to take them out, what would happen?
we're actually going to get into that question in just a second. You know, these issues of, you know, if you're corporeal, and then you start talking about being immortal, exactly how do you think about that? You just, you know, hold that thought. You'll see we actually get to that here in just a little bit. And it's going to come to a point.
So
yep. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's why I wanted to, you know, to make sure people see that. See, so it says each of them a materially modified Melchizedek's son. Now, if you just see it there, you think, okay, so they must, you know, lay down on the hospital bed and some guys with crescent wrenches, you know, work on them and modify them. But remember, that's what I was saying, you got to go back. Remember, they tell you point blank, they can modify themselves. You know, that's the thing about it, you know. So that's how you understand what's being said there.
They don't have to go to the gym.
They don't have to have someone, you know. I mean, they can modify themselves. They're one of those beings that can modify themselves. Now, the life carriers are modified too. You know, they tell you they're modified, okay, and even materially modified. You know, you could say, and they're in that initial stage, okay. But they can't modify themselves. They're, you know. So you interpret that one the other way, because you're told that you have all these different beings that come in and have to go through some sort of rigmarole that we can't understand and modify them, okay? Because they have no ability to modify themselves. But, you know, this ability, really, whether or not you're modifying yourself or someone's modifying you, you know, to John's point, wow, okay, what on earth? You know, how do you understand this, right? And this is why, you know, I've often said if I had one little question that I could ask a secondary midwayer, I would want him to explain to me in what way is he really close to me energetically. That little bit of physics we're talking about here, about how he can turn a dial just a tiny little bit, and now my hand would hit him, and photons would be absorbed and reflected off of him, and then he can turn that dial back again, and now my hand can pass through him, you know, and you know, I mean, there could be one standing right here in front of me, okay? And all he'd have to do is just turn that knob, and he would be fully physical, okay? In other words, he is physical, but there's a degree of variability to this energy that we call matter that we have no concept of. There's a way of varying it that sounds like magic to us, but it's, you know, it's because you can think of it, it's basically a reflection of how we have a flatlander consciousness. You know, we think of matter, you know, as being nothing but a two-dimensional fact, but it's actually a three-dimensional thing. And that other dimension, if you will, don't think of it literally as a dimension, you know, but that other degree of variability, we know nothing of. You know, and all these different body forms, see, are in a spectrum, in that vertical dimension, you know, but it really is all the same energy, okay, and that's where I was kind of trying to get to here. you know, to have it really sink in. I mean, yes, you have matter, mind, and spirit. And yes, there's an absolute of all three of them. There's an absolute of matter, there's the absolute mind, and there's the absolute spirit. Okay? So they are absolutely separated. But there's an aspect of reality that is super absolute. Okay? And that threefold energy, physical energy, mindal energy, spiritual energy, is one energy in a higher sense. Okay? And so this, you know, initially there's no way we can wrap our minds around that, really. And so it's we have to sort of stick with, well, there's spirit substance, and then there's a huge gap, and then there's material substance, you know, and they're very, very, very different. Okay, but in a higher sense, no, they're the same thing, differently expressed. And the way that works, you know, in a finite domain, is just two different ways. One, there are influences that can harmonize those three into a triunity. You know, so you can speak of triune energy, you know, where those three are together as one in a system. You know, you shouldn't think of them as literally monolithic. They're a harmony. Okay, so there's that harmony of the three, harmony of individuality, associativity, unity. But then transcendent of the finite, and the finite separation of those, you know, is the absonite. And there's a lot of the foundation of the finite is the absonite. Is absonite. I mean, fundamentally, this variability of body forms is an absonite variability. You aren't just gluing matter and spirit together. They're transcendently blended together, you know, as if they're one substance, which they are, see, in a transcendent absonite sense. And you can blend them in 18 different ways. Okay? Right. So this is what we're seeing. You know, this whole idea, I mean, it's enough initially to try to wrap your mind around spirit being a literal substance that one day you can stub your toe on. Okay? Not some airy-fairy notion that humans, you know, have dreamt up and basically is a synonym for distorted states of mind. Okay? No, it's a literal substance. You can build buildings out of it. Okay? Now, there are spirit things. Okay? You know, right, literally. Okay? And then there's this, coming to terms with all this amazing, complexity to energy that we have no concept of now, and Marantia, and all these things. Okay, so you see, it's bringing in this whole amazing world here of all those issues. All right, so let's see, what else do we have that we want to get up front here? So we have this literalness of the material daughter and the Melchizedek mating and producing offspring. Okay, and as long as we're delayed here, you know, are into the unpacking so extensively already, let me just say a couple things that kind of apply to the next paragraph. You know, they mentioned they're going to call these Midsonite worlds, and you see in the next paragraph they say these offspring are called Midsoniters. Okay, okay. Why exactly? What's the mid about that? Yeah?
Well, you just mentioned a minute ago that the absonite aspect with the material aspect gives me, in my opinion, the midsonite aspect.
No, not quite. But it is a blending like that. Okay, but think about, you know, they're saying they're mid-suns, right? So they're in the middle of some spectrum of sonship. Now, energy issues aside, which we can't really understand very well, you remember how normally you have a material son and daughter on a local system headquarters world, and they're dematerialized, transported via seraphim to a world, rematerialized. When they're rematerialized, they're downstepped from their nature as they were on the local system headquarters. And in that same mode, back up one notch. Okay, remember how this all gets started with material sons and daughters. A creator son in his local universe makes one pair, you know, one material son, one material daughter, for each local system. You know, they are the archetype of the genetics, you know, of in that system, you know, the material living creatures in that local system, you know, and each local system is different, you know, so he makes one that, you know, is designed just for how life is going to be designed in that local system and how it's going to be designed in this local system, etc. So you have that initial pair, and they, being direct offspring of the Creator's Son, are innately immortal. Okay, they are very much like these life carrier sons, Lanonadex, Rondadex, Melchizedex, different body energy system. Okay, but they're innately immortal. No qualification. They are unqualifiedly mortal, immortal. However, their children are downstepped a notch. Okay. Their children are immortal, so you know those children on in a local system headquarters are immortal, but it's a qualified immortality. If they actively engage you know, a rebellion state of mind, if they twist their mind to identify with what is technically rebellion, going against the harmony of the innate harmony of the cosmos, they put themselves out of that harmony and they come unplugged from what is sustaining them as immortal. Okay, so that's, you know, the immediate effect of that downstep. And then when I said when they get selected to be an Adam and Eve and they're dematerialized and rematerialized, they're downstepped another notch. The main thing now is twofold. They, one, to maintain their immortality, they have to additionally have the fruit of a tree of life, because they've been downstepped a notch, and that bridges the gap between the normal energy from the master physical controllers that sustains them. In order to plug into that, they're kind of down below the plug-in level, and that, you know, that circulatory system they have with the fruit of the tree of life, that bridges that gap and keeps them plugged in so that they stay immortal. But then also, when they procreate, they have mortal children. Okay, so...
And on that point,
yep.
But last week when you explained that the Alaxian life plasm, that, you know, we're supposed to take go through a million progeny, it's supposed to take us downstepping before... it mixed with the humans of the planet.
Right.
You know, by mixing with them early, they kind of...
And directly,
right. You know.
So for those of you in the webinar, if you couldn't pick up, I mean, he's just, yeah, just to summarize that, it brings up that whole, you know, recognition of that there's nothing arbitrary, you know, literally arbitrary about the Adam and Eve, you know, losing their immortality when they defaulted. I mean, they're breaking this link and coming unplugged. You know, so it's very literal. It's not some person that just puts his thumbs down and, you know, and someone turns a switch off or something. I mean, they're doing it to themselves. So now there's a whole great big long to do, but I wanted to, you know, you have to be able to think about all these precise steps in order to kind of see this directly, the mid-sun thing. Okay, so think about it. You've got a material daughter who's been dematerialized, transported, and rematerialized on this mid-sunite world. So she's taken that additional downstep. And so below her is really sort of just one more level. You know, normally, her offspring would be down at the level of the evolutionary creatures and can directly mate. Okay, so you have that one additional level of sons below where she is right here. Okay, and on the other end, you have a Melchizedek, and there's one notch of sons above him. You know, Father Melchizedek, Gabriel, that level. Okay, a little bit slightly higher son. See, so just think about that. See, so you know there's one, you know, higher and one lower. You know, so if you go into the middle of them, if you combine the two of them, you're literally going to get right in the middle, halfway in the whole spectrum of sons. Okay. So that's why they're mid-sons. Okay. And then the other thing, like I said, there's a whole bunch of things you want to kind of appreciate right up front here. Okay. The Melchizedek, like we were just saying, we're seeing him procreate here. Okay. That he literally has had the reproductive spark bestowed upon him by the creative mother spirit. It's there when he manifests materially. There's meiosis. That reproductive process is going. Okay. You know, and he's going to be a procreator. Where did he get that from? Go back. You had, how do Melchizedek's come into existence? You have the Creator Son and the Creator Mother Spirit, but it's not just the two of them that make, you know, all of the Melchizedeks. They, by themselves, just make the Father Melchizedek. Okay. And the Father Melchizedek, he's not a creator, he's just a creature, high creature, relatively so, but just a creature. But we do know, as we'll see in the next paper, the Father Melchizedek is a procreator, and so is Gabriel. Those two can get together and procreate and produce spirit offspring. Not material offspring like we're talking about now, but spirit offspring through a procreation process. Yeah. So when you make the rest of Melchizedek's, you know, and it's the Creator, Son, Creator, Holy Spirit, and the Father Melchizedek, the three of them together that produce the rest of the Melchizedek's, you can just think about what one of the reasons why he's there. Okay, he's this downstepping procreation conduit. Okay, there's a definite downstepping, and you're seeing that those Melchizedeks, are being created sort of below a level that of the type they are, that a Creator Son and Creator Mother Spirit can do directly, and also you want to actually bestow procreator ability into them. See, so that's coming through the Father Melchizedek. Okay. So they are procreators in his image, the Father Melchizedek's image. And here, you know, they don't do that spirit procreation thing like we saw the Father Melchizedek doing. They're downstepped. And interesting, it appears that what they have to do is dial themselves all the way down, and then the procreation can manifest. So they become, you know, a very definitive expression of what procreation is, contrast to creation. The pro prefix means through. Okay, that the creative, you know, the creative activity, or the creator activity, is not coming from them but through them. You know, so when we procreate, you know, we're not creators. You know, that creative activity is going through us, because the creators can't create down at this low a level directly. But they can use us as a downstepping conduit and do it through us. So our children are the Creator's children, technically, not our children. Okay, and remember, they remind you that even in the marriage and family life papers about, you know, creating children for the Father. Right? That's technically what we're doing. Okay. All right, so I wanted to bring all of that up front, you know, because we want to be thinking about this as, you know, with as much detail as we can to appreciate, because they've just got a handful of paragraphs here, you know, that they're teasing us with. So we want to really try to appreciate what's going on as best we can. All right, let's get some more.
The progeny of a Melchizedek wife carrier and a material daughter are known as Midsoniters. The Melchizedek, father of such a race of supernal creatures, eventually leaves the planet of his unique life function, and the Mother Eve of this special order of universe beings also departs upon the appearance of the seventh generation of planetary offspring. The direction of such a world then devolves upon her eldest son.
Okay, so just added a couple little things there. So, you know, we don't know if the Melchizedek is staying for just to get the first generation into play, or perhaps he stays a little longer. But, you know, it's obviously, you know, doesn't stay all the way through to the seven like she does. You know, we know that much. Yeah, but he at least has to obviously stay through the first generation because he's responsible for the bringing the first generation into existence. And then she eventually departs too, and we'll see in a little bit here where they go when they depart. But that's you know, that's kind of interesting right there. You know, so I mean, you're already getting the sense. I'll bet you these worlds, you know, don't have any of the normal sorts of regimes of leadership and stuff. You know, this is probably a very different scheme, and they don't give you, you know, anything to really, you know, go on. But you can just kind of already feel the very fact that basically the Adam and Eve, you know, of the world, you know, are gone in a blink of an eye. You know, there's nothing normal about that. In a normal world, Adam and Eve are there for, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of years. Okay? You know, somewhere in the light and life, maybe they'll finally leave. Okay, so, you know, so you're wondering, these beings may be pretty self-governing and self-motivating, you know. And maybe there isn't as, you know, if there is, you know, sons that come, it may be sons that are not even revealed to us, you know, things like that. So just kind of just see what the implication of that they must be pretty integrous. If mom and dad can just, you know, leave before the first son, has died or whatever they do. We haven't figured out yet what, you know, what the deal is here, but we're about to read it in a second here. You know, but the oldest son is still there to take over, so that's pretty, you know, leaving a pretty, you know, near term. All right, so let's see what they say next.
The Midsonite creatures live and function as reproducing beings on their magnificent worlds until they are 1,000 standard years of age, whereupon they are translated by seraphic transport. Midsoniters are non-reproducing beings thereafter because the technique of dematerialization, which they pass through in preparation for enseraphiming, forever deprives them of reproductive prerogatives.
Okay, so two things there. First one, okay, so there it is. So 1,000 standard years, which is how long in our years?
5,000,
yep. It's a 5-to-1. Okay, so they live on, no hint of any dying or anything happening here, but just right at 5,000 of our years, they're dematerialized and transported somewhere. Okay? Now, you know, we want to note that second part. Okay, you know, we've been trying to think, you know, as precisely as possible about these issues of the reproductive spark, the living vitality, those two different phases of the life animation, which, like I said, we haven't literally been introduced to formally yet because it's the end of this paper. But we have those two different phases of the life animation, and they're non-reproducing, okay, after they're rematerialized. Okay, so in other words, the reproductive spark, that phase of life animation, you know, which is engaged to them while they're living on the Midsoniter world, when they're dematerialized, that disconnects. Okay? It's like, well, when they're rematerialized, why doesn't it reconnect? Okay, well, how does that rematerialization thing work? At the other end our life carriers who are, you know, overseeing the whole process of rematerializing them. Okay, and they're in their mid-phase mode. When you know that material being is all put back together again, just in the presence of that, those life carriers, that living vitality, that basic level of life animation, reengages them. They're reanimated with living vitality. You know, and so all of their cells are animated again, and they're off and rolling. But they're not going to re-bestow the reproductive spark, see? Because they're not in that mode of, you know, they're only in that mode when they're, you know, doing life and implanting life on an inhabited world.
You're not going to get your reproductive
spark either. Right, just, you know, remember, see, that's the thing about, you know, that reproductive spark. That isn't, you know, as environmental sort of, quote unquote, an issue as the living vitality is. I mean, if you're just in the environment of a life carrier, that's going to engage you. Okay, but not the reproductive spark. Okay, so they're not reproducing. Yeah, Gene.
Melchizedek, who came to this world and made Eve, he was a reproducer. Did he not have to feel seraphim?
Yes, he did, but remember, he's got a way around this. You know, he can be in a transportable form when he's in seraphim and a transporter. He doesn't have to be dematerialized at all. Yeah, you know, when he gets here, then he turns the knob and makes himself materially manifest. Okay? See, so he stays connected to the reproductive spark, you know. I mean, you know, when he's being transported and whatnot. Now, okay. Now this brings in this other, you know, see, that's why we went through all those details. So see, now you're recognizing something that's special about a material son and daughter, you know, not just the first pair, but, you know, that all of the children that are on a local system headquarters. They can be dematerialized and rematerialized without being disconnected from the reproductive spark. Okay? And this, see, must have something to do with the way they're made by a creator's son, and how he has that spark kind of embedded within himself. Remember how Jesus, you know, spoke of that aspect. See, so you see this in these material sons and daughters, that they can be dematerialized, rematerialized, and they're still reproducing. However, mortal children of an Adam and Eve, like all of our Adam and Eve's children who were taken off, okay, that's not the case, okay? When they were dematerialized, transported to Edentia, and rematerialized, okay, they were unplugged from the reproductive spark. They're not reproducing, just like the Midsoniters here are no longer reproducing once they've been dematerialized and rematerialized. So, you know, those children of Adam and Eve that are on Edentia, are not reproducing anymore, you know, so they can't be brought here to, you know, literally mate with us to biologically uplift us. They're not reproducing anymore. Yep.
So is that kind of why, was it when they told Jesus you can't leave any offspring behind, did they say he couldn't have any or couldn't leave any behind?
Oh, no, right. I mean, he could have, but oh my goodness. You think it's wild when a Melchizedek mates with a material. What happens when a creator being, okay, that has life within them, not a procreator, a creator, right? See, you know, no, you cannot do this. I mean, not to mention, it probably, you know, the child couldn't survive. It would probably disrupt the child. But you know, nonetheless, just, even if you can imagine somehow it could, you know, technically could work. I mean, you know, he would be stowing some kind of incredible energy. right. Okay, so just a little side here. Like, there's some fun asides, see, that this brings up that you can think about. So, I don't know, have you ever thought about those children, you know, of our Adam and Eve that are there on Edentia? Okay, so, you know, we know they're not reproducing. Okay, what else can we figure out about it? You know, think about it, because remember, they're mortals. Okay, well, they're still living, okay, and a long time has gone by. Okay, you know, they tell you that they're not, they haven't died on Edentia. Okay, so how is that? Okay, well, when they were rematerialized, okay, there must have been a modification here. They must have put that additional, quote-unquote, circulatory system stuff in them so that they can use a tree of life, fruit, you know, and be plugged in and be sustained. Otherwise, they would have died a long time ago. I mean, it's been almost 40,000 years since they were taken away. Okay, they don't live that long. No. I mean, you know, they had no choice but to be caught up in the default, of course, you know. But you know, that it's only in Adam and Eve that can technically default, right? You know, because they're the only ones that have been given a sacred trust, right? Yeah, just to think about that, see that little issue, I mean, see, so it's got to be, you know, kind of like what they did with the 100 Andonites, see, you know, that they, you know, where they used their DNA to make the 100 bodies for the prince's staff, you know, those 100 Andonites got modified so that they could plug in, you know, and be sustained. So those Adam, you know, those children of Adam and Eve, same thing must have been done to them. They must have been modified. For them to be still ongoing, okay? now, as far as we know, when the Eve is dematerialized here and transported to, you know, where they haven't told us where they go yet, but when, you know, when she leaves after seven generations, you know, I guess we have to assume that she's still, dematerialized and rematerialized like she was before. At least that seems like you initially would want to, you know, would assume that she'd still be reproducing wherever she goes. But as you see, when we get there a little, you know, in a little bit, you know, we'll start to question that. We'll pick up that in a minute, you know, about, well, what exactly is her state, you know, after this event. Okay, let's get a little bit more here.
The present status of these beings can hardly be reckoned as either mortal or immortal. Neither can they be definitely classified as human or divine. These creatures are not adjust or indwelt, hence hardly immortal. But neither do they seem to be mortal. No Midsoniter has experienced death. All Midsoniters ever born in Nebadon are alive today, functioning on their native worlds, on some intervening sphere, or on the Salvington Midsonite sphere in the Finalitors group of worlds.
Okay, there's a zillion things we can pick up on here. All kinds of, okay, so let's just start at the beginning there. All right, so, okay, so they're pointing out, I mean, you know, they're offspring, you know, at least of a material daughter, you know, so you kind of think of them as being mortal, quote unquote, like we've been saying, you know, Adam and Eve have mortal children, you know, and they don't, that whole issue with the adjusters, you know, for, normal Adam and Eve's children, you know, we've talked about that some in various places, you know, there's all kinds of questions about exactly how that works, you know, in terms of finally getting into a mode where they sort of, you know, will be perpetuating themselves and their children will be getting adjusters at roughly age six, you know, because their parents had adjusters. But see, you know, Adam and Eve don't have adjusters. So their children don't automatically get adjusters because they have them. You know, their children have to get to the point where they get an adjuster on their own merit. You know, by getting up the third circle or whatever. Okay. Now, once those children have an adjuster, then they can have children, and those children, you know, can benefit from the, you know, remember, there's, you know, still within the mind, presence of the parents till roughly age 16. Okay, and so that adjutant mind has an adjuster in it. Their parents, and so they can get an adjuster at roughly age six, It's like the kids on the probationary nursery, because their parents there have adjusters, okay? But, you know, for that first generation, you know, so like if, you know, one of them could definitely die before they get an adjuster pretty easily. Like if he was killed by his brother, right? Right, so those issues in play. Okay, but you know, that fact that you don't have this immediacy of adjusters. Here you're seeing, okay, I mean, Melchizedek doesn't have an adjuster, and this material daughter doesn't have an adjuster. So there's nothing that would say somehow kind of automatically these Midianiters would get an adjuster. And it appears that that's extended out, you know, to the end of the finite. I mean, they appear to not be adjuster, acquiring beings at all. Okay? Thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of years go by, and they're obviously very, very, you know, high order quality beings, and they're not getting adjusters. So, you know, I mean, they just must be not adjuster like beings. And, you know, look at what sense you're getting. So, I mean, when a Melchizedek mates with a material daughter, obviously his nature is being downstepped in that offspring. But, you know, the other way around, her nature is being upstepped by him. Okay, well, how far is it upstepped? Well, they're still material beings, but they seem to be basically unqualifiedly immortal. Oh, just like the original material son and daughter pairs in the local systems. They appear to be kind of at eye level, these Midianiters, with those original pairs of material sons and daughters, where they're unqualifiedly immortal. Okay. Okay, now this sort of when you recognize, see that they're, that means that the unqualifiedly immortal,
right.
Unlike, okay, I don't know, you weren't here yet when I was explaining all that earlier, okay? I'll just, you know, give you a little quickie, that the children of those original pair are not unqualifiedly immortal. If they disrupt their mind, they become mortal, okay? But the original pair never rebel. They're integrous and immortal. Okay? They're like these Midianiters. You see, the fact that, you know, no Midianiter has experienced death, i.e., none of them have chosen rebellion either. All right? They're integrous, like those original pairs. Okay? I mean, think about that. Oh, that's pretty clever planning on the part of a creator son, that he'd make the original pair integrous, isn't it? Yeah, you can't make them so that they, you know, that would be a problem. Right? They're integrous. Okay, and so are these Midianiters.
They may not get planetary princes either.
What was that?
Think they get planetary princes?
Well, see, that's, you know, that's what I'm, you're wondering if they have planetary princes or anything like that. Yeah, I don't know. Like Doug was bringing up, now think of the other side of this. Okay, I mean, they're material. Okay, now, and all Midianiters ever born in Nebadon are alive today, and none have experienced death. So, well, don't trees fall on them sometimes?
Yeah. So, don't they have accidents?
Right, don't they have accidents? Don't, you know, aren't there accidental deaths on a Midianiter world? Okay. Okay, this is trying. If you think about this, this is kind of reminding you of another issue you may not have thought about. You don't have, you know, like those original pairs of Adam and Eve having or material sons and daughters having a tree falling on them either. Okay, obviously, theoretically, a tree could fall on them. We have an environment here that's very controlled in some way. I mean, just like we're on an architectural sphere. All the I's are dotted, all T's are crossed. No one goes, well, it seemed like a good idea at the time. That doesn't happen. Okay? Not even the guys have experienced death. Okay? Because it seemed like a good idea at the time. Okay, so this, it's telling a little bit more about what a Midzoniter world is like. It's very much like, you know, the way material beings can just go on and on and on and never die accidentally on architectural worlds and stuff like that. I mean, on Havona worlds, is there any hint that those material Havona natives have accidental deaths? Okay, but if they're material, you could imagine hacking them in two with a sword.
There's no need.
Okay, but it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. See, so just think about that, you know, that aspect of it.
A question I'm sure is already been answered. On the original Midsonite worlds, the first or second generation that have the ability to procreate.
No. Every generation has the ability to procreate.
They have the ability to procreate.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Then I know the first one.
It's only after they're transported off the planets that they can't procreate.
But how? Can they have unlimited numbers of offspring?
Sure, right. You have 600,000 generations down the road. I mean, you know, it's a part of the...
There are a bunch of Midzoniters hanging around.
Well, see, but again, I mean, that... Well, yeah, they're accumulating, you know, where we're about to see here. But notice the fact that, you know, they're taken off automatically when they reach 5,000 of our years old. Okay, I mean, you're not, you know, they're not going to, you know, be, you know, shoulder to shoulder on the Midzonite world after a while, okay? You know, because none of, you know, there's no disease to, you know, to cut, you know, to thin the herd and, you know, this sort of stuff. Okay, so, I mean, it's a very managed, see, world. Yep.
You have two questions on here. I think you might have inadvertently touched upon one. One question is, why couldn't the returned children of Adam and Eve receive thought adjusters? And the other question is, how many Midzoniters does a Midzonite world end up with?
Okay, well, we have no way to answer the last question. You know, we don't know, is a Midzoniter world, does it go all the way to the grand universe being settled in light and life? Or does it get abandoned after a while? I mean, you have no idea. You know, it might, you know, not literally get abandoned, it might get used for other things and there's no more Midzoniters, you know, after some point. Who knows? They don't tell us any of these things, so we can't answer that. But the other thing, okay, I was just going to talk about that a little bit because there's all kinds of things that are in play here. So we got that whole issue. Okay, they don't have adjusters, but like I was building up to this. So I was trying to get you to see that these Midzoniters, you can think of them as kind of on the same level. Some sort of like parallel expression of the original material sons and daughters. They're at that level. Well, if that's the case, you would expect to see a lot of interplay between these two groups of beings. Okay? And yes, you do. Okay, so here you see... when they say all Midzoniters ever born in Nebadon are alive today, functioning on their native worlds. Okay, so, you know, obviously there's always some that are still under 5,000 years old there. Okay, they're on their home world. On some intervening sphere, okay, for instance, they tell us that a Midzoniter, when they leave their home world, like when, you know, a Midzoniter leaves the Midzoniter world in our local system, they can elect to go and work in the probationary nursery. Okay, around Gerasim, before they go onto the Salvington Midzonite sphere and the Finalers groups of worlds that we're about to read about. Okay, so if they go and work in the probationary nursery, who are they working eye to eye with? Material sons and daughters who have volunteered to work in the probationary nursery. See, they're very much, you know, simpatico here, okay? Working eye to eye with each other. Flip it the other way around. And this gets into the question, that other question was asked. Okay, so when you're talking about a material son and daughter who have become an Adam and Eve on some world, Or if you're just talking about the material sons and daughters that are ongoing on in the local system headquarters world. Down the road a ways, you know, in the case of Adam and Eve, you know, when you're in enlightened life, deeply in enlightened life, either of them can elect to leave the local system headquarters world, or leave their, you know, their mortal world, the world that they've been overseeing for so long, and they are dematerialized, transported, and rematerialized, and when they're rematerialized, they're humanized is the word that they use. Okay, in other words, they're modified so that they can get an adjuster. Okay, they're material, but they don't have a socket for an adjuster to plug into normally. But if they're humanized, then they have this capacity, they have this space within them that an adjuster can come, and eventually they fuse with an adjuster and they're ascending mortal, and they, you know, we finally get into the core finality like we read a while back. Okay, so so there is that avenue, and guess where some of those individuals that choose to go ahead and get humanized and get an adjuster, those material sons and daughters, guess where a number of them go? To the Midsonite world. So they're dematerialized, transported to the Midsonite world, are rematerialized, humanized, get an adjuster. Okay, so do the Midsoniters get to experience death? No, not themselves, but they get to live on a world where there is death. Those material sons and daughters eventually die. That have been transported there because they've been humanized, right? Now they may die in a flash of fusing with their thought adjuster, okay, right? But they die. Okay, so think that's an interesting aspect. See, to these Midsonite worlds, they have material sons and daughters who've been humanized, who are mortal now, and have adjusters living there with them again, eye to eye. Okay. So there, it's a symbiotic system here in the local universe with the material sons and daughters and the Midsoniters. They're complementary in various ways. Okay. So that's another intriguing aspect of them, and you know, in a number of ways. See, like think about that situation. Those Midsoniters, you know, in a way, are of a higher kind of innate nature than those material sons and daughters who are going to die in. Well, now, you know, they're immortal, but they're kind of like alternative parents. Those Midsonators are a lot like that original material son and daughter pair, the original parents of all the material sons and daughters. So this is very interesting, see, relationship between them. Okay, all right, so now we're about to read about where they're destined to go in the near term here. As they said, on the Salvington Midsonite sphere in the Finalitors group of worlds. What the heck is that? Well, let's read some more.
The Salvington worlds of the Finalitors. The Melchizedek life carriers, as well as the associated Mother Eves, go from the system Midsonite spheres to the Finalitors worlds of the Salvington circuit, where their offspring are also destined to foregather. It should be.
Go ahead and read that other one. Yeah.
It should be explained in this connection that the fifth group of seven primary worlds in the Salvington circuit are the Nebadon worlds of the Finalitors. The children of the Melchizedek life carriers and material daughters are domiciled on the seventh world of the Finalitors, the Salvington Midsonite sphere.
Okay. So. We had an anticipatable pattern going here as we were going around Salvington, you know, taking one group of seven worlds at a time. We had the first group of seven for the Melchizedeks, the second group for the Veronidecks, the third group for the Lenonidecks, the fourth group for the life carriers. That all seemed pretty predictable as we kind of, quote unquote, went down the hierarchy of suns. We were going around the worlds. And then they throw in this, it's like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. the next group, the fifth group of seven, are the finaliter worlds. Okay, so you just sort of just have to accept that little tidbit. We'll pick up on that way down the road a ways, you know, a pattern that you can notice about that. But so they're all gathering on that seventh world. Okay, so first of all, the loose end that I mentioned. Okay, see, you know, here they remind us again. See, not only the Melchizedek life carriers, but as well the associated Mother Eves, you know, are going here indefinitely. So they're taken out of the whole material son and daughter, you know, pool. See, so when you're sitting there thinking about that, well, okay, I mean, there's nothing that I can see, you know, purpose for her to be a reproducing being anymore, I don't think, unless there's something really amazing they aren't talking about here. So maybe not. I mean, maybe when she's rematerialized here, maybe even the case that she's so modified by engaging Melchizedek that when she's dematerialized and rematerialized, maybe it's just automatic that when she's rematerialized, she's different. I don't know which it is. But it's kind of suspicious that maybe she's not reproducing anymore once she's rematerialized. If she's sort of just going to now be, you know, an ongoing immortal being, I would think she probably still has to, you know, like the Midsonite, her Midsonite children have to have, to be ongoing and being material like she is. She's going to, you know, if she's not innately material like they seem to be, I mean, innately immortal like they seem to be, she probably has to have the Tree of Life fruit, you know, things still going on, I guess. But again, maybe there's some modification that, you know, transcends that. I don't know. A lot of curious things there. But that's kind of, you know, a curious thing to think about just in itself. Forget about all those details, but just, you know, to take this being that really seems to kind of just be made to do the Adam and Eve thing and all that, and you don't, you know, and it's like, well, they can be humanized, and then they could be like an ascending sun, and that's, but to just kind of take them out of any of that sort of mode that's like us in any way, procreating or ascending suns, and just make them a material being that's ongoing and living on a world around Salvington, and you know, that's a little, that's kind of shades of the material beings in Havona, you know, being just, you know, they're just material and they're just, you know, they're not only immortal, they're eternal beings, of course, you know, but that idea, you know, which is kind of hard for us to wrap our mind around, that you could have sort of immortal matter like that, and immortal material beings, you know, just not changing at all. You know, they're not growing, evolving, changing, or anything. They're just immortal and yet they're material. Okay? So they kind of, that's kind of an, you want to, there's a reason I'm kind of hinting at that, because that's kind of a curious little thing to know, that you see, it's like, that seems a kind of similar to material Havona sorts of ongoingness. I'll tell you why I'm saying that when we get to the end here. All right, so they're all gathering here. Now, there has to be something that we can recognize about them telling us it's a seventh world. Right? And we've talked about this before, you know, occasionally they would tell us, like, which sector a secret was in on one of the Father's world or something. You know, occasionally notice when they give you a detail that it's like, well, you know, I don't know what the heck difference it would make if it's on the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or seventh primary sphere. You know, they told you it's a seventh, so you can deduce something from that. What can you deduce? Well, they're put on the seventh world. What's special about the seventh world? Remember, you know, we got to go back to our pattern. We have 70 primary spheres. Why do we have 70? And the string of pearls around Salvington, because it's 10 times 7. Okay, and unlike Uversa here, you have 10 groups of 7. Instead of 7 groups of 10, okay. Okay, that sevenfoldness, okay, which sevenfoldness is that? Is that the sevenfoldness radially in the central universe, the seven circuits of Vavona? Or is that the sevenfoldness around the central universe? Which pattern is it, which sevenfold pattern is it manifesting? Is it manifesting the infinite spirit, you know, in the master spirit sevenfold pattern, you know, around? Or is it the Paradise Trinity sevenfold pattern, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7?
I would think it's the Trinity because I think it's connecting to the absonity aspect of things, but maybe I'm wrong.
But you're jumping ahead is what you're doing. I'll explain in a second. It is the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the seven primary worlds is the master spirit like sevenfoldness. You know, remember, like, you know, go back to the life carrier list of seven. You know, remember what they told you about each of those worlds. Remember, that's, you can reflect on those. It's Father, Son, Spirit, Father, Son, Father, Spirit, Son, Spirit, Father, Son, Spirit, as you go through those seven worlds. So if you get to the seventh life carrier world, the sphere of unrevealed life, and remember, the unrevealedness was, we're talking about the triune. You know, we had matter, mind, spirit issues, and then we had the triunity of matter, mind, and spirit that was being dealt with on the seventh world. Seventh master spirit, you know, the master spirits, that's the one that is innately in tune with the Trinity. Okay, and hence, you know, with the Supreme, because the spirit and personality aspects of the Supreme come from the Trinity, okay? That's the Trinity sphere, precursor to it, you know, and because it's the seventh master spirit one. Now the actual 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 of the seven circuits, that's the six sub-satellites and then the seventh sphere. That's seven, okay? But see, it ended up being, either way, you're pointing to the Trinity, see? And you had the right instinct there. That's a little hint. There's something, well, after all, they are wards of the finaliters here, and the finaliters take an oath
to
the Paradise Trinity, not to the Father, not to the Son, not to the Spirit, or any pair, or any, to the fourth fact, to the Paradise Trinity. This is all about some sort of very direct association with the Paradise Trinity. Okay, and hence the mother that stems from the Paradise Trinity. Right? So that's what they're throwing you little hints about that. Okay, let's see, what else do we have there? Let's read some more.
The satellites of the seven primary worlds of the finaliters are the rendezvous of the personalities of the super and central universes who may be executing assignments in Nebadon. While the ascending mortals go about freely on all of the cultural worlds and training spheres of the 490 worlds comprising the Melchizedek University, there are certain special schools and numerous restricted zones which they are not permitted to enter. This is especially true of the 49 spheres under the jurisdiction of the finaliters.
In other words, more than any of the other sets of 49, you know, the other 10 sets of 49 around, you've got a lot of very, very definitive Trinity space here, i.e. Havona-like space. Yeah. You know? You know, again, remind yourself, the seven circuits of the Vavona, you know, is where the Trinity is engaged. Not the Father, not the Son, not the Spirit, the Trinity. You have the Father circuit, the Son's circuit, the Spirit circuit, you know, that are directly tied to the three infinite persons, their deity. And then you have the domain of the Trinity, the seven circuits of Vavona, proper. If you have beings coming from everywhere, including the central universe, if they they all need to have a home, kind of a place that feels like home, Well, you've got all of the flavors of the seven circuits of Avona available here, obviously expressed in a very finaliter-like transcendent way, so that they are bathed in an environment that's suitable for their residence there. You know, I don't know exactly what I mean by that, but you know, you get the idea. Is that must be what's going on there, okay? Whatever it is, you know, they're going to feel right at home because those worlds are going to be attuned to a Havona-like Paradise Trinity footprint flavor, okay?
You can't go there.
And you can't go there yet. You've got a long ways to go before you're of that. Right. But obviously once you've, you know, you're of that central universe sort of flavor, yeah, right, you'll be out there. Because they, after all, are the finaliter's worlds. Okay, so that's, you know, that, you know, see, all of it is, you know, as you unpack the details there, it's all, you know, giving you a predisposition of wanting to try to figure out at some point, or at least, maybe I shouldn't say figure out, but be in a mode where you might recognize at some point, as you're unpacking all the details in the book, you'll be reminded, oh yeah, I got to remember, those midsummers have a lot of very close tie to the Trinity and the Mother because of that, and you know, can I find things that match up with that at some point? Okay, so everything about it here is just, you know, dripping of that. Okay, oh yeah, it's not just the finaliter's worlds, but it's the finaliter's world that's the most, you know, Paradise Trinity-like because it's the seventh master spirit-like one. Okay, so it's very, very biased, see, to the Trinity and the Mother. All right, let's read the last one.
The purpose of the Midsonite creatures is not at present known, but it would appear that these personalities are for gathering on the seventh finaliter world in preparation for some future eventuality in universe evolution. Our inquiries concerning the Midsonite races are always referred to the finaliters. And always do the finaliters decline to discuss the destiny of their wards. Regardless of our uncertainty as to the future of the Midsoniters, we do know that every local universe in Orvonton harbors such an accumulating core of these mysterious beings. It is the belief of the Melchizedek life carriers that their Midsonite children will someday be endowed with the transcendental and eternal spirit of Absonity by God the Ultimate.
Okay. Now, that's one of the, that last sentence is one of the more, well, that's way out there sort of sentences that you can run across in the book. Okay, so a very interesting thing happened. You know, I can't give you the details because it's a gigantic, you know, process, but sure enough, okay, like I've told you a number of times here, when you actually start unpacking all of the details of the central universe, you know, like I've done in that initial paper on it, you're chugging along, you know, recognizing the patterns, following the consequences, unpacking it, figuring out what it implies. And notice what how they say this. It is the belief of the Melchizedek life carriers that they're Midsonite children, etc. Okay, is that like superstitious religionists just believing in, you know, any old thing, that kind of belief? No, I mean, by belief they mean the Melchizedeks have gone through a very rigorous process of insight recognition and deduction. And to the best of their deductive abilities, they're pretty sure that they can deduce where the Midsoniters fit into the picture. Well, guess what? We can too, with what they've given us. As you unpack the central universe, and you're working through this deductive process, you figure out the exact process that the deductive process the Melchizedek life carriers went through. You deduce and you understand exactly what they mean by transcendental and eternal spirit of the obsonity of God, the ultimate. You can actually precisely deduce that and figure that out. Okay? So that's another thing I can tease you with. You know, down the road when I offer a really advanced course, you know, for those that have gotten to the point where they feel like they have some mastery of total deity, you know, and we want to try to do a course even beyond that, you know, the things that, you know, like I've been telling you over and over, that you can put together when you unpack the details of the central universe, you figure out who the Midsoniters are, you figure out what this quote-unquote spirit of its obsonity is, all that is deducible. Yeah, it's obviously deducible because the Melchizedek life carriers have deduced it. But guess what? They've actually included enough in the revelation that we can deduce it too, just like they do. That's pretty cool.
Is it possible that they might have something to do with the people from first outer space level coming through in the future as part of the fact that they're more in the transcendental state?
They definitely have something to do with...
you know what I'm asking?
Yes, I do. And notice how they were hinting towards that. The purpose of the Midsonite creatures is not at present known, but it would appear that these personalities are foregathering on the seventh finality world in preparation for some future eventuality of universe evolution. Okay? In other words, it looks to them like things are kind of in station-keeping mode until you get to the grand universe settled in light and life. And that's what I'm saying. You can put those pieces together. You can see how that works. You can see exactly what's going on. That was probably of all the things that I unpacked out of that process, you know, the least expected. I wasn't even remotely trying to somehow rationalize that sentence there. I was just going along, and all of a sudden I had this puzzle piece, you know, that had to be. And I looked at it as like, I know what that is. That's a Midsoniter. And the spirit of obsonity. It just naturally comes out. So it's pretty fun, you know, that the revelators have given us. Again, it just reminds you, you know, revealing the architects of the master universe. You say, they've given us the ability as mortals to get into a deductive, intuitive relationship with information that is so beyond the run-of-the-mill normal world. Even a normal world post-bestowal, and certainly our goofball world, which is only, you know, post-bestowal with a great big giant asterisk after it, you know, right? Are we post-bestowal, or are we still just post planetary prince, or are we even post-planetary prince? Are we still back there before the planetary prince came? Not civilizable yet, right? It's pretty fun stuff, you know. And you know, it. See, when you do that, then you finally understand why it was. And I mentioned that, you know, back in paper 30. You know, there's a curious appearance of a mention of the Midsoniters. You have that unclassified and unrevealed orders list, you know, that starts out with a consummator of universe destiny and goes through all sorts of mysterious things that you don't know what to make of.
Where's that?
It's toward the end of section one in paper 30. You know, and the last one in the list is the Midsonite orders of the local universes. And you're going, well, that seems like a non sequitur. Why in that? Well, you know, they see, once, you know, as you're unpacking the central universe, you figure out all those beings in that list, you know, including the unnamed reflectivator liaisons of Magistan and all of them. I mean, they all pop out, and sure enough, one of the puzzle pieces is the Midsonite orders. It's because it actually is part of, it's with them in that set that comes out when you're in that mode. You know, you deduce them at the same time you deduce these other beings. Yeah, that's why it's there. All right. Well, hey, we still have a little time. I thought sure we'd we'd never make it through the Midsonite section. and so we won't do all of of the seven agitated mind spirits, because that's a pretty big section. Yeah, and but I was thinking about this, and if we did have time, there's a nice little preface part of this section. It has all kinds of juicy items that we can pack unpack here.
A comment here. Since the terminology is a belief and not a knowing, is there the possibility this won't happen?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to stress. So when the kind of belief that Melchizedek has is the kind of belief that you want to strive to have. Not mere belief, not, you know, just the literal technical definition of the word belief, mental acceptance. Because, you know, just purely subjectively, you know, just directly like that, there's no boundaries on it. You can believe anything, okay? I mean, you want to talk about what unqualified means, you know, there's a great example right there that you've been given access to such a domain. You know, you can believe anything, okay? We're not talking about that, where you're functioning in a purely subjective recognition of the word belief. All those subjective things that, you know, that are innately, you know, they're subjective in and of themselves. You want to put those into a self-mastery, okay? Where all of your beliefs are predicated on objective recognition, you know, like if you're just specifically talking about, you know, in a religious sphere, you know, very circumscribed religious sense, and a belief there, you know, your belief should be predicated on faith, okay? And faith is not what humans have always thought it is, you know, you got to get the proper definition that the revelators are trying to get. You know, it's personal recognition. It's what you have when you combine your personality with this third cosmic intuition and that insight, you know, and that ability to grasp with the mind and with your personality grip, spirit fact. Okay. So that's what you want to understand about that. It's impossible to not have belief. You can't somehow not be partially a subjective mind. Melchizedek's have subjective mind. They aren't somehow some sort of a magic, purely objective mind. Because what is subjective mind? What's it relative to? Because obviously I'm speaking about it being a relative phenomenon. It's relative to the subject. Subjective consciousness is relative to the subject. What's the subject? The self. Every being has a self. Okay. Beings high and low have selves. You know, a creator son has a self. Okay. When you're actually getting to the point of going through a thinking process about something, there's a mental acceptance as part of that process. You're letting that process roll. You've accepted it, and there's no off switch on that, you know, that mind activity. It just rolls. You've accepted that you're going to let it roll. You know, but what did you start that process out with? You know, did you start it out with an objectively, you know, mastering hand that told it what its initial assumption needs to be, so that belief is predicated on conformity with the cosmos. You've attuned the initial assumption to the cosmos, okay? And then you accept the consequences of deductive reasoning, okay? So that's why I'm saying the consequences of his deductive reasoning, his belief, okay, like I said, you can do this. You get the correct initial assumption, and sure enough, deductively, out comes Midsoniters and the spirit of Ibsonity, you know, related to God the Ultimate and everything, okay, in a very fun way. All right, so Yeah, so that's a great question, whoever brought that in. It's important to stress that that's what we're, you know, a lot of what we're trying to do here is about lessons in self-mastery. You know, we're trying to get to the point where something is actually directing that incessant clamoring thing we were given, that adjutant self, okay? You can't turn off, you know. It doesn't matter, you know, how many delusional religionists there have been throughout history who've somehow, you know, imagined they could somehow just turn that off and free themselves from the evil of the self. No, the self is not evil, and it's not supposed to be turned off. That's why it doesn't have an off switch. That's why God didn't put an off switch on it. You are supposed to take a hold of it and master it. Universe is mind made and personality managed. Yourself needs to be personality managed. Okay? It's not self-managing. It's not a creator being. You know, see, their self is self-managing. That's handy. But creatures don't have self-managing selves. Creatures all have selves that have to be managed. Okay?
Runaway lad, there's two things you can't run away from.
Mm-hmm. Self and exact part. Right, see, that's the truth. See, he was trying to tell him what I was just saying there, see? Yeah. You know, that's delusional to think you're going to somehow run away from that. I mean, just ask yourself, who put it there? God did. Okay? It's probably not garbage. You probably shouldn't be trying to figure out how to throw it away. Why did God give it to you? Okay, what's it for? All right, speaking of adjutant mind...
Segway.
Since Andre brought this up a couple times ago here, with the title there, let's just recognize, why are they called the seven adjutant mind spirits, quote unquote? That last part. What's the mind spirit part about? Well, maybe I should just, you know, throw in the adjutant part. You know, why is it called helper? Because your adjutant mind, basically, in the lower domain of the hourglass, okay, it's your associating mechanism. Your personal self works through that associating mechanism to engage the external world. Okay, it's your helper. Okay, in engaging the external world. Okay, so that's why the adjutant. Now, why is it mind spirits? Okay, for those of you who've noticed details, you may recall that occasionally you're reading along and you see spirit hyphen mind. And here you seem to be seeing mind hyphen spirit. And what's the difference? Why are the revelators flipping them? Okay, now, when you think about a local universe, it's the easiest place to see this, you know, understand it very directly. So you have a local universe. It's a universe, okay? It's a womb. There's a mother that's establishing, you know, that domain, making it one turning, a universe, okay? And in our case, it's not just a womb of mind. It's a womb of both mind and spirit. You know, she not only, her ubiquitous presence, not only has a ubiquity of mind energy, you know, within it, but a ubiquity of spirit energy within it as well. So she's both of those presences together. If you go up to the super universe, the two are separate and superimposed, but here they're together as one. One being is delivering them simultaneously. Okay, and if they say spirit hyphen mind, okay, they're talking to you from the bottom up point of view. You know, your individuality viewpoint, how you engage this presence. Okay. The mind is, you know, is what you are initially engaging, and above that is spirit. Okay, so you say spirit hyphen mind. So in other words, the foundational element is mind. You start with mind, and then spirit is added onto that. I mean, for instance, just I'm going to use my adjutant mind, and I'm going to try to get up and actually use my circuit, and then the Holy Spirit on top of that. See, that's spirit added to mind. Spirit hyphen mind. So you have this spirit hyphen mind womb. When you're looking at it from the bottom up, how it relates to you. Okay. But now we're going to be talking about her ministry. Okay? We're talking about it from her point of view. Her reaching down to engage us with seven fingers. Okay? Seven phases of mind. Okay, from a top-down point of view, spirit is the foundation, mind is second. Okay? So as they are delivered from her, you properly call them mind spirits. The root is spirit. You know, she's a person. Personality is spirit pattern, not mind pattern. See, so the foundation element there is her personal ministry they're about to tell you, right? So spirit she is first, and then, you know, it's being downstepped to mind as she reaches down. Okay, so that's why they're called mind spirits. Okay, but in terms of how they engage you as mind energy. Okay, and then you're going to reach up through them to try to get to spirit. So it's just two different ways of looking at the same fact.
That's great.
Okay, and just like with the Supreme, if you want to fully understand the Supreme, you got to think about both directions at the same time. You have to think about the upwelling Almighty and the downwelling Mother, put them together in order to get the Supreme. So same thing here, to really appreciate what's going on, you know, look at it from both perspectives. And the name just constantly reminds you to, don't forget, you know where this is coming from. This is coming down from spirit. All right, so let's see what they say.
Number five, the seven adjutant mind spirits. It is the presence of the seven adjutant mind spirits on the primitive worlds that conditions the course of organic evolution. That explains why evolution is purposeful and not accidental. These adjutants represent that function of the mind ministry of the infinite spirit, which is extended to the lower orders of intelligent life through the operations of a local universe mother spirit. The adjutants are the children of the universe mother spirit and constitute her personal ministry to the material minds of the realms. Wherever and whenever such mind is manifest, these spirits are variously functioning.
Okay, so notice that they literally gave you a top-down picture. They started with the infinite spirit, brought it down to the creative mother spirit, seeing down to you. Just like I was saying, okay, they're mind spirits from a top-down point of view. Okay, so you got that. Now, you know, they're about to qualify all this, but, you know, longtime readers, we all know, when they say the adjutants are the children of the universe mother spirit, okay, children, quote-unquote, okay, they're not beings, they're not even entities, okay? There's nothing individuated in a very literal energy sense about the adjutants. You have a continuum of mind energy, okay? There's no gaps in it, you know, nothing has been divided, no separated, you know, literal separation. It's a contiguous energy system. Within that energy system, however, in terms of down at the low level where it engages us, where it minds us, there are seven phases to that. You know, so a word like phase is, you know, or they'll use circuit, you know, if you want to bring in that analogy. But, you know, when you don't want to bring in the circuit analogy, you just want to talk about them, quote unquote, as children, there is a quasi-individuation to it as seven phases, or, you know, almost you could say facets, but I don't want to use the word facet because I don't want to bring in the deity picture, you know. But phases, just like we talked about, you could talk about the tenfold, you know, energy system of, you know, material energy and talk about phases. So you have seven phases. And the thing that it's hard to appreciate, again, until you unpack the central universe, is some of these details about talking about the adjutants. But I can give you a sense of this. Remember, when you're talking about mind, even though it's not often literally, you know, you aren't literally reminded of it, you want to always keep in mind when you're thinking about mind that there's two aspects to mind always in play. There is the literal energy aspect, it's called mind energy, And then there's a separate aspect called mind activity. Okay? That's not the functioning of mind energy. That is a literal separate aspect that's separately bestowed within the system, has a separate reservoir, you know, from which it's drawn, from the reservoir from which the mind energy is drawn. There's these two aspects to mind. Okay, and most directly, the childrenness of this, the separateness that they're speaking to, is different flavors of mind activity, you know, which you can deduce exactly, you know, what they are and stuff. Okay, and that, but that mind activity is intimately associated with mind energy, and so the mind energy ends up being having a separate flavor to it as well, as it's doing its energy thing. Okay, but the very fact that you have kind of the separateness, you know, sometimes they'll talk about it where they sort of just kind of speak of it as if you had sort of just a vanilla mind energy. Okay, and then you had seven different activities being imposed upon it. Where if you misinterpret that sort of language, you know, you might think that somehow the adjutants aren't literally your mind, that there's some sort of ministry engaging your mind, like the Spirit of Truth. But no. Okay? I mean, the adjutants are literally your mind. It's not like you have some mind and then they're reaching down to it. You know, they are your mind. Okay? Their energy and activity in this sevenfold fundamental phasing and all of the associativity and superadditive consequences that come from that. Okay? So that's why the language is like that sometimes. Because you have kind of a measure, you can kind of sort of think of it, that activity is kind of transcendent of the energy, see, so it's kind of like above, quote unquote, you know, and sort of directing it from the energy from above. But don't take that very, very literally. Okay? Don't take their statements to kind of speak like that too literally. See, they're just trying to give you the spirit of that differential when they do that. Okay, yep.
So if they're literally your mind, yep. And it mentions here just a minute ago, you know, that they don't, because I've read the book before. After a while, when you evolve into higher states, you no longer use your hatchet, so to speak. So yep. Your mind then becomes something.
Okay, so again, just so you think about this as all you know, a continuous energy system that not only has a horizontal continuumness, you know, contiguousness, you know, so that you don't want to think about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 with gaps in between them horizontally, in any sense, but also vertically, there's no gaps. So you're working with these seven phases, and more of those seven phases are becoming one phase, you know. As you go up and there's no gaps, you know, the seven phases become one phase of both energy and activity. For us, it's called Marantxa mind energy and Marantxa mind activity. Okay? You know, so like I was saying, it's literally, you know, the hand analogy and the fingers, you know. Think about the hand as a Marantxa mind, you know, and it reaches down, and if I had seven fingers, you could see it directly here. You know, those are the seven adjutants. Okay? And you're being touched by seven fingers, but you work your way up the fingers, and eventually you're just working in the hand. Okay? And that's Marantxa mind. Or parallel to that, if you're a seraphim, say, you're using a single phase mind that's parallel to the Marantxa mind.
So if all the mind in our particular, in this room, comes from the same mode of spirit,
yep.
Then we're all tapping into the same mind.
Yes. All right. See, and this is.
And we're not thinking the same thing.
Right. Right. And that's.
Sorry.
No. So if you're talking about whatever, John is bringing up this issue. So, we're all using the same mind, basically. And the answer is yes. And this is a very important thing. We don't want to go off on the ramifications of that totally, because that's a huge story. But remember, there's no mind that's individuated and given to you. You have an unbroken energy system, and we're all plugged into it. And we're all just quasi-individuated in that system. Like a simple analogy is, think of that continuum of mind energy as being a rubber sheet. Okay? And you don't literally punch a chunk out of that rubber sheet and hand one to John and one to Chris and one to Barbara, okay? You just grab a hold of that rubber sheet and pull it down and lock it onto, you know, a material seat. And pull another one down and lock it on, okay? It doesn't tear, very flexible. Okay, so you're quasi-individuated. You're designed to stay kind of down in that little well, quote unquote. It's an analogy. Don't think of it literally. You know, but you're down in this little well. But obviously, there could be things where if you don't stay localized like probably you're supposed to, you might drift out. You could pick up things out here. You could might even dribble over into another well, pick up something in another well. The fact that there aren't gaps. That's why occasionally humans describe very mysterious things where they seem to know someone else's thoughts or they seem to be picking up on a dead language or, all right. It's all in one energy system. Everything that's ever happened in this local universe. Not only every human, but every single creature that's ever lived has been using the same mind energy system. Every amoeba, every bat, every dog, every whale, it's all, okay, all in one mind energy system.
That's how other some beings can tell what's going on in people's minds.
Right, and that's why, animals, when they don't have the higher stuff to confuse it, then they just are kind of engaging it in an energy level. They can pick up on, on the twists and turns of your use of the energy system, okay, and some humans can do that and stuff. Right, there's all these things. Okay, we could talk for 50 hours on all the ramifications of that. That's very important. Humans have never imagined that we are all plugged into a contiguous energy system like that. Okay, and currently science, doesn't even believe in mind in a literal sense in general. It's just a functioning of brain, which is illogical. But obviously my collection of molecules is between my ears and it can't be over there. Yeah, but the mind energy that I'm using is over there and over there and, on a planet 60 light years away and, okay? Okay?
They're like seven fingers, you said fingers, but seven actually, right?
Yeah.
Seven adjutants or five for animals?
Yeah, see, it works perfectly for the five fingers for the five adjutants for an animal, but,
Oh, you have to put the bunny.
How many fingers?
Oh, is there something? Yep.
Organic evolution versus material evolution?
Oh, I'm glad. Okay, glad you mentioned that. Yeah, I mean, when they say organic evolution, they're talking about actual biologic evolution as opposed to, say the physical evolution of the Earth. It's just material evolution. Yeah, and I wanted to just mention that in passing. Remember, this what they're alluding to there is has a whole paper dedicated to it. What's that paper called? After you go through the historical geology papers, there's a paper that goes through the story again, and it's called The Overcontrol of Evolution, right? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. How is evolution overcontrolled? By a mind, engagement of matter. Mind dominates matter, so it can overcontrol it. So they tell the story materially, basically, or living matter, the living matter story, and then they tell the story again, the parallel mind story, okay? Because mind is, the engagement of the adjutants is evolving along with that, and it's, it's over-controlling. So it's gonna have a lot to say about, phyla and things like that, all right, let's read some more.
The seven adjutant mind spirits are called by names which are the equivalents of the following designations. Intuition, understanding, courage, knowledge, counsel, worship, and wisdom. These mind spirits send forth their influence into all the inhabited worlds as a differential urge, each seeking receptivity capacity for manifestation quite apart from the degree to which its fellows may find reception and opportunity for function.
Okay, so just a couple quick points there. Remember back when we were in paper 34, we unpacked that whole bit about are called by names which are equivalents of the following. They picked those names out of the 11th chapter of Isaiah because they worked really well as parallels. They just had to tweak them a little bit. And, use both the King James and the Dewey Reams translations to do it and whatnot. But, you know, so just reminding us of that. And then a very important thing there is differential urge. Okay, this is reminding you that, directly of the energy part, the mind energy part, that the adjutants, you can think of them eventually in a full personal context as a spirit of something. But when you don't have personality and spirit energy directly involved, they're just energies of something. Okay? Differential. Remember, technically what, you know, most sort of, you know, abstractly, what an energy is, different from a force has no differential. You know, it's the same everywhere. But if you do something to that force to make a differential in it, to make it different in two locations, that differential is an energy. Okay? So there, and when you talk about the energy aspect of one of them, it's an urge. Okay? If you talk about the spirit aspect, more, you know, the spirit of something, that's an impulse. Okay, so they'll use those two words, urge and impulse, whether or not they want you to think more on the energy side or the spirit of, quote-unquote, side. You know, the higher, more kind of self-animating-like aspect of it, the impulse, see, as opposed to the urge. Okay? So you know, they're reminding you, we're literally talking about energy, too, here. Don't just think about activity. Differential urge. Okay, and yes, they have to engage, you know, sequentially. You know, the second adjutant can't engage before the first adjutant engages, either in the evolutionary process or in your development. Okay, but once they're engaged, they, like they're saying here, they, you know, they're working in and out, you know, that ministry of the Creative Mother Spirit is working in a seven-phase fashion. Where if phase five can get something together, even though phase three can't, phase five does it. Now, it may cause some problems. You know, you want to be as symmetric as possible. See, so the fact that they're separate like this to a degree, that's why there's all the differences. You know, when the adjutant's attuned to each of us, you know, we have a natural genetic bias where we favor some adjutants over others. You can do that because of what they're saying here, right? Because they have that degree of freedom. Right? So they can attune to all of our differentials and give us all those nagging differentials where I'm lopsided with these two adjutants. And so I've got to, you know, work on trying to get myself symmetric and get all the adjutants up, you know, together in harmony. No, that's what they're saying. I mean, most fundamentally, it attunes to the genetics. That gives you the initial lopsidedness. I mean, everyone's going to be lopsided to some aspect, especially since we didn't get the full biologic upland blending. You know, we're all going to be quite lopsided in our initial engagement by the adjutants. Okay. And then, nurture is going to impact this too. Nurture will bias you, maybe, you know, pour gasoline on the fire of your nature bias, or maybe it'll help mitigate that, or, you know, whatever. Yep.
Choice come through mind or matches.
All right, so spiritual choices come down as mindal decisions.
Within ourselves.
Right. So because we have a personality and, you know, and a relationship to spirit, we can make choices. An animal can't make choices. So you make a spiritual choice, and that is downstepped into the mind energy system as a mindal decision, you know, an actual form in the mind energy system.
And that's kind of where free will comes in?
Well, free will is about the spiritual choices, see? Right? And when they talk about adjusters, you know, they talk about an intimacy with decisions, not with choices, because the adjuster's in your mind. Right. See, it's there with those mindal decision forms.
Choices, not adjustments?
No. Choices are one thing. The adjusters,
oh, you said
adjusters are related to the decisions directly. Okay, because they're within the mind, literally. You'll notice them very carefully, you know, speaking like that, reminding you that it's your decisions that are immediately, you know, touching the adjuster, not your choices. Okay. Let's see here. Okay, get some more.
The central lodgments of the adjutant spirits on the life carrier headquarters world indicate to the life carrier supervisors the extent and quality of the mind function of the adjutants on any world and in any given living organism of intellect status. These life mind emplacements are perfect indicators of living mind function for the first five adjutants. But with regard to the sixth and seventh adjutant spirits, worship and wisdom, these central lodgments record only a qualitative function. The quantitative activity of the adjutant of worship and the adjutant of wisdom is registered in the immediate presence of the divine minister on Salvington, being a personal experience of the universe mother spirit.
Okay, so that's the last one paragraph we're gonna read for tonight. Let's just unpack that. You know, there's some really fun things there. Okay, we've alluded to this. So you have these amazing central lodgments, they're called life mind emplacements. Because we're not interested in like the kind of mind energy that's in the communication conduits, you know, where they lay out some physical energy and some spirit energy, then you have a super additive consequence of some mind energy, you know, that the communication is actually going to go through that. Okay, we're not talking about that sort of mind. We're talking about mind, you know, that's engaged to living matter. Okay, this is what we're, you know, monitoring here. Okay, all right. So and that's why they threw in the life mind thing. But, you know, the mind-boggling statement. Okay, so the extent and the quality, okay, and you can kind of think that's sort of like the energy and the activity. Just kind of keep it simple, the fact that there's sort of two aspects. So there's a quantity and there's a quality because there's an energy and an activity. Okay, so both of those are being registered here. So the mind function of the adjutants on any world and in any given living organism of intellect status. Okay, so I can go to the headquarters world on the life carriers. I can go to this facility. I can go into the room, I can turn the knobs, and I can get an exact readout of the quantity and the quality that a particular amoeba on a particular planet, you know, in Nebadon. Think about that, okay? Every single thing that's adjutant-minded, all animals, including single-celled animals. If you wanted to know how a particular amoeba was using the first adjutant, because that's all it has, you can literally go there and not only figure out the exact, you know, way it's using, you know, there's mind activity, but, you know, the exact way that there's mind energy engaged. I mean, is that not, you know, you talk about magical things. Trying to wrap your mind around that. Okay. You know, what it means to be functioning at higher levels and have greater awareness of things. Okay. That's pretty amazing stuff. Okay. Any given. Okay. pretty amazing. But there you have it. Now, notice it's not, you know, your spiritual consciousness maybe got thrown for a loop there. When you were reading that, were you expecting the quality to only be registered in immediate presence or the quantity?
Quantity as in capacity?
No, I mean, literally, there's the literal energy aspect to it, and then there's the quality of what's going on, the mind activity. You know, which, you know, this facility, this, you know, this machine or whatever the heck it is, you know, we're supposed to think about here, this emplacement, measures the quality of the sixth and seventh, but not the quantity. Isn't that interesting? Okay. See, so the reason, you know, is when we're talking about the sixth and seventh, we're talking about adjutants that have some immediacy of connection to personality activity. And there, you got to remember, a creative mother spirit is one of the supreme creators. Why are they called supreme creators? Because the supreme creators, through them, one aspect of the supreme is created, the almighty part. The mother part is coming down, the almighty part is coming up through the supreme creators, and what's going through them? That summation of everything, that quantity, okay? You know, the almighty, that facet of deity, is the summation of the total finite, okay? So, and they tell you that it's those parts, you know, that go into the almighty, the parts that are related to the sixth and seventh adjutants. See, it's the quantity part related to personality activity, and she's directly aware of that as a supreme creator, and she reflects that quantity through herself and into the Almighty, so that the Almighty reflects that measure of quantity. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's that spot where they tell you about the sixth and seventh being, you know, being related to the supreme. See, this is the details of that. And see, it's not the quality, the personal purposive part, you know, of the supreme is the mother. That's coming down. It's the power pattern part, the almighty, that's coming up through the supreme creators, the more quantity-like part. I mean, you know, in a simplistic sense, you know, when all is said and done and you have the supreme being, you can kind of think of the almighty part, or if you individualize it, the almighty supreme, you know, becomes the body for the supreme being, the quantity. Okay. But the personal purposive part, the universal mother part, yeah, it goes into the supreme being. See, that's what the body's up to. Okay. That's why it's the quantity there, because she's a supreme creator and she's creating the summation.
Though you then normally think of worship and wisdom on a qualitative level as more of a quantitative level. So it's the quantity of the quality, so to speak.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. But.
Right. Just, yeah. Just, and I'm very purposely trying to get these various facts very distinct in your mind so that you can start to reflect. See, there's all kinds of ramifications as you start to reflect on this. You get these things separated apart, you know, and keep them apart. You know, remember, constantly remind yourself, you know, well, I got it, you know, is the energy part the important part there? Is it the activity part? And, you know, and etc. And you notice, right, you know, we came right back again. You know, you start to understand why they tell you you need to really, really get the thing about the twofold, you know, the upwelling and downwelling aspect of the supreme when you're going through the supreme birth. You've got to get that figured out because you live in the domain of that. Everything is like that. You're going to understand anything that's going on in the universe of universes. You've got to see it as part of this bi-directional flow creating process. So you constantly, you know, are coming back to that. All right. So we'll wrap it up there for now. And see, next time, see, then we shift into going into the specifics of the adjutant. So it's a great spot to break right here. All right. Let's take a moment here.